Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to the Dear Lovejoy podcast, sponsored by Cooker, spelt quicker, pronounced cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I think it's one of the best gadgets I've got. In fact, it might be the best one. I love mine. Anyway, today we answer the question, what is it like to be wrongly imprisoned? And to answer that question is a man who has been wrongly imprisoned in India. Hello, Nick Dunn. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Tim. Good morning.
Good morning. Where are we speaking to you from?
I'm speaking from the town of Ashington, Northumberland, which is famous for the most recent late Jack Charlton. So, actual town, and I've just found out his funeral and drive around the towns on Tuesday. So, it's going to be a massive turnout because he was such a big, warm figure in our community. And he would always give you the time of day if you ever saw him out and about.
Yeah, I've worked in football for years and I never met Jack Charlton. The one thing that I heard about him, which was so good though, and the why he got so much out of that Irish team, is apparently I can't remember which player told me this once, that he said he started treating them like men. And he said, there's no curfew, but you're in the World Cup. And you're never going to get this chance again. So what's the point in going out and getting drunk when you can actually just play football? Also, you're putting yourself on the shop shelves and so the shop window so people can see you. And who I can't remember who told me now, just said it was the best thing ever. They then went, well, we're here. Let's make the most of it. And he just got such a team spirit in that Irish team, definitely.
He did, yeah. He did. I was only young during the World Cup of 94. And he did wonders for the Irish team, yeah. Can't fault that.
All right, Nick, let's talk about you because I wanted to find out what it's like to be wrongly imprisoned. I imagine it's absolute pure hell. I feel, not taking anything away from it, but I feel in the beginning of this lockdown, I felt quite imprisoned because we weren't allowed out. We had to queue for our food. But I was in quite a nice prison because I was in my house in West London with a nice garden and access to Netflix. So it wasn't too bad. I imagine being imprisoned in India is a completely different kettle of fish. I suppose you should tell us the story of how you ended up in prison.
Yeah, back in 2013, I was doing private contract security work to stop Somali pirates from hijacking commercial ships around the high-risk area. And for those who don't know what the high-risk area is, it's basically from the top of the Red Sea through the northern point of Africa and into the Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean, etc. And we would be on board these vessels and we would make sure they go from A to B in the safest manner. I was quite fortunate. I never had any attacks because doing our job obviously prevents any sort of attacks from the Somali pirates. So a lot of these captains, and obviously there's a big film starring Tom Hanks, and the real Captain Phillips actually supported us. And I remember my local ITV doing a video link interview, and he basically said, I wish I had those guys on my vessel because we wouldn't have been hijacked, simple as that.
So Nick, what's your background to get the job on a vessel?
My background is parachute regiment, and during that time in the parachute regiment, I worked on operations with UK Special Forces. I've done tours in Northern Ireland, Afghanistan and Iraq. My time in the military was from 2004 to 2010. And I just felt like with a lot of the guys of my era were wanting to, we all wanted to spend a lot of time in the military, and I still have friends still in the military today, but it was just a big bloom in private work and everyone was jumping ship, you know, no pun intended, but everyone was wanting a different challenge, and yeah, it was exciting. It was boring at times, but it was good. It was something different and I enjoyed it.
So we'll get on to how you end up in prison in a minute. So you're on a boat and you're protecting yourself from protecting the boat from Somali pirates. The reality of it is if they come to your boat, you can have to shoot them. Is that the idea?
No, this is what led to my incarceration. It's not like when you're on land where your reaction and all the stuff that you train to do has got to be straight to the point in split second reactions. In maritime, you don't realize how much time you've actually got on you, because judging distance while on a high platform of a vessel along the sea, it could take ages before they're even in close proximity to pull a trigger. But you go through different procedures. So just being there with your weapon above your head sometimes is enough for them to go, now, we're not even going to risk our life. Even when they're high on cat, as a lot of the Somali pirates would take to give them the adrenaline rush to try and attack these commercial vessels. But you've got a lot of things to do before you even pull the trigger. And most of the time, the Somali pirates will go, you know what, I'm going to live to fight another day or steal another day. But unfortunately, on a certain incident in January 2012, it didn't go that way. And two Italian Marines working for the Italian government, just like our Royal Marines on...
Oh, Nick, you paused. Nick, sorry, you're there. Yes. Again.
Yes.
Italian Marines.
Yeah. Yeah, so in our situation, we had the Italian Marines. They had an incident in 2012 where they, how would you put it? I wouldn't class it as murder, but they didn't do their job properly in the procedures before you would pull the trigger. And if anyone's been in India, Indian people are very inquisitive. So you can imagine an Indian fisherman in their little boat looking at these, say, massive container vessels or bulk carriers. And they'll come to see what the name is on the side of the vessel. So these Italian Marines have mistaken them as pirates, not done any warning shots, or basically they've killed them, unfortunately, and it created a massive international incident. And later, we became the scapegoats, look, if you come near our waters and this, that, and the other, we'll take you and make a meal of you and an example of you, and that's what they've done for us.
So they came to the boat, did they, the Indian authorities, and then they took you and stuck you in prison and charged you for what?
Well, when we were off the coast of India requiring fuel and provisions, there was a cyclone, and under maritime law, you, under them duress situations, can seek refuge in a neighbouring country, and that's what we done. But the way things had progressed and the amount of people that was at port side in a short space of time does indeed raise a few concerns for it. But yeah, the Coast Guard came to meet with, they tell all their media they intercepted us. Well, you can't really intercept an anchored ship. really. And how would you know where we are? Yeah. So we believe we may have been set up by our agent who was basically procuring the fuel and provisions. And the Coast Guard, armed, came on board, just said to the vessel, this was happening during early hours, so most of the people on that vessel were asleep. It happened early hours in the morning of October the 12th, 2013, and they told us to go to the port of Tutankhamun. And from where we were to how fast our vessel was going, it took quite a few hours nearly to get there. And the reason being is because when we entered the port of Tutankhamun, there was a massive welcome committee. Loads of different reporters from around India, the local media. There was different organizations from as far as Mumbai. And if you look at the time on when we got, say, nabbed by the authorities to being at portside, unless you had a private jet, how on earth are you going to get from Mumbai to, which Mumbai, for those who don't know the geography, is on the west coast of India, and I was on the southeast coast of India, and India is quite a large country, so it kind of raised a few concerns, but everything was up in the air, and we were just told to just keep out of the way while the higher authorities of our vessel dealt with the police, but it clearly wasn't enough in the end.
So they put you in prison. What did they charge you for?
They charged us for illegally entering the country, which we didn't because they invited us in. And they basically charged us for having illegal weapons. They basically looked at a bunch of weapons, and just because some of the weapons may have had, like, say, an A for to stand as automatic, even though the weapons that we used were designed and had parts removed and be unable to add them again for single shot only, not weapons of war, they deemed these weapons as automatic weapons. So they kind of abused their own ballistic experts' reports to put us in prison.
Did you enjoy that job, by the way? Because it sounds horrific to me already. There's guns, pirates.
To be honest, I did enjoy it. I went around different countries of the world. The main country that a lot of the security guys go to was Sri Lanka. And, you know, it's a lovely country. I went to different places in Africa, the Middle East, and you get to meet some amazing crew. And yeah, quite a lot of them are fearing. And when they see you, they're always, thank you, sir, and trying to shake your hand, because it is scary, because you've got to imagine these people are just trying to just earn a living. And one minute, if we're not on their vessel and they go through the high risk area, they could end up on the port of the coast of Somalia, being held to ransom. And they do fear for their lives, and we do make a difference.
Yeah. How was the prison then? So cut to the bit where you're actually in prison. We always have these sort of thoughts and imaginations of what these things will be like, and it doesn't feel like it's going to be pretty to me. What is it like in a prison in India?
It's a prison. The basic of basic. There's no beds. It's just a empty room, slate floor, and a hole in the ground for a toilet. And I always say this to anyone who asks, just like yourself, and I'm not saying the UK prisons should be like that, definitely not. But if they take away quite a lot of the luxury stuff that our UK prisons seem to have, I do 100% think crime will go down because no one will want to go into a bleak prison. Did I cry for my mum when I was in that prison? Of course I did. So Mr. Tough Guy prisoner in the UK, lovely prison system, if he was in my shoes, I reckon he would do the same, because you're 5,000 miles from home. You can't just pick up a phone to call your family. I saw my family 3 times. My sister came to see me on one occasion when I was at one of my lowest points. She surprised me and brought my dad. But I never saw my brother. I never saw my mum because of 5 days before Christmas 2013, she suffered a double aneurysm whilst I was in prison. The prison itself, it's like a jungle. We were the only English people in that prison.
When you say we, there were 6 of you, is that right?
There were 6 British, but in total, there was 35 of us. And it was built up of 12 Indians, but they stayed at a different prison to us, and we couldn't fathom why. So there was 14 Estonians, there was 3 Ukrainians, and 6 British. And we were a big group. So in the prison at one time, there'll be 23 foreigners to India. And the first, we were in 2 different prisons, you know, it was like a four-year nightmare of 1 minute you're in prison, next minute you're out, then you're a free man, then you go to trial, and then you go to prison to say serve a 5-year sentence. Luckily, we won our appeal, because on the grand scheme of things, I'd literally still be serving my sentence today. And the way this year has gone, I'm glad I'm at home with my family.
Mm. So you're in the prison, and when you were writing your book, you've got a book out explaining it all in much more detail called Surviving Hell. How many years ago was it you were there?
It all started October 2013, and I came back to the UK December the 7th, 2017. So from, say, January 2018 to present day, I've been rebuilding my life again, because my life ended in 2013. The life that I knew, my mental state, I missed so much in such a... Yes, it's only 4 years, but for me, it felt like a lot longer. And I've missed... I missed my own 30th birthday, because I celebrated that in prison. I missed family birthdays. I missed, well, quite a lot of my friends had children of their own. And I missed so much. And when you hear about this whilst in a prison, it does bring your morale really low. And you feel like, why is this happening? Why is it happening to me? Why is it happening full stop? And you've just got to rise above it.
Do you feel like your life is in limbo then whilst you're sitting around waiting? Is that what happens?
It was definitely in limbo, especially when our case was going through the court, because 1 minute you'd get it. It's not like they always kept referring. We mirror the UK court system. And I'm thinking, well, I can't remember ever hearing someone in a UK court turning up, and then either the prosecution not turning up, or the judge, in fact, not turning up, and then going, oh, well, we'll just delay it for 2 weeks. I've never heard anyone of that happen in the UK, but it was happening on such a regular occurrence whilst we were in India, and it destroys your morale, because you don't know if you're coming or going. You're thinking, well, the court date's happening, so your morale goes high, it builds up, and then it just goes bang, ripped away from you, because a prosecutor can't be bothered to turn up. So they just go, come back in 2 weeks. And you're like, how are we supposed to go? You're saying we're guilty. We've given evidence that we're not. but you're not going to entertain it in court because you know you've got no leg to stand on, and you're going to use delay tactics. And that's what they've done practically for 4 years, use delay tactics.
Do you know, Nick, I hate to do this because what I'm going to say is it's so ridiculous in comparison to what you've been through, but I'm drawing a few parallels. I've been speaking a bit about people being a little down during the pandemic. And, you know, we have had, in a way, not like you have by any stretch of the imagination, but in a subtle way, we've had our freedom taken away. You know, we're queuing for food and all that sort of stuff. And what you've said there is really, really poignant. It's we were all sort of in it together. And then every now and then you think, oh, we're over this. They're letting us out. And then you look at a graph which shows the pandemic hasn't gone away, or it's leveled out. It's not going down anymore. And then you go, exactly as you say, it's like, bam. Oh my God, we thought we were over it and now we're back into it. And I think we're going to have a lot of problems when if we ever have a second wave. But I can just see from and hearing your voice there, you talking about it, the disappointment when you think you're about to get out and then bam, you're back to where you started with it, started again.
Yeah, it happened on, we called our court date Judgment Day. That is what we nicknamed our court date, Judgment Day. And I'm only human. I've got feelings, but I remained as positive as best I could. And I try to keep the group of 23 guys who have all different backgrounds, three different cultures. The way they see things, quite a lot of it was not positivity from a few of the guys. And I don't blame them that. But you've got to remain realistic and optimistic as best as you can. And I always try to keep the guys feeling happier. And yes, I did get a bit of negativity from the guys. But do you not want to go into a court date feeling positive but realistic? Because it can go one or two ways. It either goes in your favour or it doesn't. 9 times out of 10, it always went in their favour. But I try to spread as much positivity in the camp as possible. And some of the guys before court dates would come up to us and say, and just want to feel that they could say things and get things off their chest, even if it was like, Nick, I really miss my family and I hope this goes well. And I said, you're not the only one who misses their family. I can't wait to see my family. Especially when I nearly lost my mum due to a double aneurysm. And the survival rate for a normal aneurysm is that low. It's your brain just going, I've had enough. But my mum showed drive, grit and determination to see her youngest again. And I had to keep my spirits up and I wanted to give it to the rest of the guys.
Did you take the leadership role then?
No, I didn't. But when it came to court dates, I wanted to keep everyone above board. A couple of the guys, I wouldn't say we're all in it together, but a couple of the British guys, they were able, during the time before we went into prison the second time, build up, got all the paperwork and doing a lot of ringing around and created a massive appeal process, to trials, paperwork to give. So our lawyers, our legal team had something to take to court, because if we never did that, no one would have been able to do it. You know, the families back in the UK couldn't do it. We had to do it. We kind of had to fight our case from behind bars.
What about the British government? Didn't they step in and help you?
The British government itself back in the UK were always referring, we cannot directly involve ourselves in another country's legal system. I totally respect that, because you wouldn't expect India jumping in and going, oh, we'll release them. However, I'm not too sure about the way the British government goes on nowadays. They'll probably just go, okay, no problem, you can have them. But if the shoe was on the other foot, India would they're like ostriches at the time. They just put their head in the sand and just go, yeah, cheers. And we found that quite regular, and it is very frustrating. But I've got no direct anger at the British government. I do believe in July 2014, when we had literally zero charges against us, we were literally free men, and the Indian police had 90 days to appeal. And during that 90-day appeal process, in Indian law, we had letters from two of our lawyers stating we do not need to remain in this country. We had people from New Delhi come down to Chennai and turn around and say, we don't believe they'll appeal. So when it gets close to day 19, you're going to be thinking, we're going home. And then on day 88, they launch an appeal at Supreme Court. Your morale scores plummet. Your hope is dashed. Your anger is towards the British government, because they could have gotten us home at that time. The people from the consul, like the deputy high commissioner, the girls that used to come into prison to pass letters from family, etc. 10 out of 10. I have no fault in what they did. If I had any personal problems or whatnot, I would tell them. It would hopefully get sorted. If I had any problems with the way I was treated, or, you know, anything that was happening that I didn't like in the prison. And I didn't used to cry human rights, definitely. I didn't think my human rights were breached, even though they kind of messed with me mental state. That's the only torture I could more or less say I went through. But I've got no fault in the consul staff whatsoever within the British government.
Nick, let's talk about your mental state, because you know the way you're describing it, it seems like a real roller coaster of emotions. First of all, when you come to write this book, surely there must have been a part of you which went, I want to leave this all alone. You're writing the book. Does it bring it all up again? Do you have to relive it?
Yes. When I was going, it took nearly a year to do my book, and I had fantastic help. And the person who was helping me do this book had a good understanding, a lot of patience. And he would turn on and say, do you want to just end it for today? I know you're getting very emotional with certain things. I said, no, we've carry on. We keep plodding on, because he's recording, hearing my emotion, and he's going, I know how to do this. And that's why when people have read my book, and I can now say this, a lot of people are saying, Nick, it's very gripping, because that's the emotional side of it. And yes, it is very emotional going through it. And there was times where I felt like, I can't do this. I just want to throw the towel in. It's too emotional on certain things. But I'm doing this because it's kind of closing a chapter in my life, and hopefully opening another one, hopefully giving me new opportunities. Because I've got to remember here, my life that I knew it ended in 2013. So from 2018, I've now got to think of new goals, new aspirations in life, a new road to go down. I'm not the same person as I was in 2013.
What are you doing about that? What are you going to do?
Well, the past couple of years I've been readjusting to society, because a lot had changed from 2013 to 2018. And I was like taking so much in, and I'm thinking, my head's going to have a meltdown here.
Go on, give us an example. What's changed?
Well, I thought life as we knew it back in 2013, yes, it was a little bit crazy then, but speed up 4 years. All the stuff that I'd missed, we had a radio in the prison, and I didn't even know, they weren't even telling me who was singing. So I'm writing down lyrics, and I'm hearing new music. A lot of new films came out at the time. Seeing my friends with children.
How about mobile phone or smartphone technology? Had that moved on?
Tenfold. The phone I was using was a HTC 10 at the time, and that was like so outdated. I'm surprised it worked when I got it back off the ship after a year. It was like a relic of some sort to me. I was like, how do you use this again? And it's mad because when I came home, because I'd been doing my washing in a bucket, learning to consume water, I could wash in it with 10 litres. And I had long hair. I grew my hair in prison for 2 years. A bit longer than 2 years, actually. So your life is different. So when I came home, it was a culture shock. And some people can't mentally cope. And I remember putting my first ever load of washing in, and I'm looking at my washing machine and I'm going, how on earth do I use this contraption? I had to ring my brother and I said, how would you use the washing machine? He goes, just turn it one to the right and press start. I went, the simple things we take for granted.
How about food?
Food, the main staple diet when I was in China was rice and dal or biryani. But in prison itself, we practically lived on one staple meal a day. And we'll try to take other stuff to keep our diet, like obviously eating a bit of porridge and stuff. You know, people would send me parcels of a bit of Haribo sweets in and stuff like that. So you do lose quite a lot of body weight. But the food, horrendous.
How about food when you got back, though? What did you...
My first meal when I got out of prison was a steak. So that was like eye of a needle, if you want to. I should have weaned myself on, but I thought, I've not had a decent steak for 4 years. I'm eating a steak. I don't care what the outcome is. I don't care. And our food in the UK to how it is in India is like totally worlds apart, and
especially in prison.
Definitely. I even saw the prison's food that they were serving the Indian prisoners deteriorate because India had a massive shortage of pears, which is one of the main ingredients that they used to make dal. So we used to call it muck on a truck because I don't even think my dog would eat it. It was just like abundance of rice. And I can't describe the smell apart from it was minging.
Right.
But it appeared like an oily, watery, fiery red liquid. And they just would pour that on their rice and have chapatis. And that was what they were feeding the prisoners 3 times a day. And we were like, you know, if we eat that, we're not walking out of this prison. We'll be carted out. So we decided to cook our own food. And we cooked as a group of six. And obviously the Estonians, they cooked separately for their guys. So it was a little bit more manageable for us. But we're not chefs. We're not Gordon Ramsay.
Hold on, how are you allowed to cook yourself in a prison? I can't visualise this prison now because I'm just thinking like it's a British prison. Does it not look like?
I did manage to get some cheeky pictures, and I did upload them on the social media when the time was right. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get any of the kitchen pictures because it's quite a dark, doomy, gloomy kind of building. But you'd walk in and it would be noisy, the stench, the heat. You'd sometimes might get the odd bit rat running around. Yes. And there'll be the massive big rice pots, the cooking, they'll be doing their darling, and we would fight for a gas stove, and we would get like a big wok. And what the prison provided us each day was a measly tiny piece of chicken, mind the prisoners only got a chicken once a week, unless they were the A-class prisoners, like political prisoners. They would get chicken any time. But that's what when I referred to is what the British consul done was able to allow us to at least get chicken every day. It wasn't chicken breast, like probably UK British prisoner would eat. It was a measly chicken thigh of some sort or whatever, neck in the beginning.
But you're not in a cell then. You're all together in a big compound. Is that how the prison works?
We're in a compound, and then obviously the first prison we're in a little cell, so there was four of us. But when we spent after the conviction, like a big room, and at first they threw all 23 of us in there, and it was cramped. And everyone has different hygiene levels, and you've just been sentenced to 5 years, so tensions were flaring and altercations with different people, and you'd get the Russian-y Estonians shouting at you in Russian. I'm thinking, if you're going to try and kick off with us, at least try and speak English, because I'm going to clue what you're saying here. Typical ignorant Brit, I suppose. But we're all missing our families. We all should be home, but we got thrown in prison together. Let's be a united group. Let's stick together. And obviously, sometimes it wasn't as easy as that. Sometimes there was us and them, you know.
I'm desperately trying to get my head around the mental side of this. So for me, the worst thing you could ever do to me is stick me in prison. I just couldn't.
That is probably the worst thing you can do to a human being. Mm. Take the freedom away.
So exactly right. So you've said a few times that you missed your life, your life stopped. It kind of implying you wasted life. Life was wasted there. Are there mentally, obviously we've discussed you've gone a huge roller coaster. We can go deeper into that in a minute. But are there any positives from being four years of your life being stuck there? Have you managed to take anything away from it and gone, this is a growth in me, or you know, I've grown, or is there anything there, any positives?
I'm a lot different in how I think. I'm still the same Nick Dunn as to my friends. I still have the same sense of humor. That was like one of the first things my friend said was, they went, your hair's grown, they took your freedom away, but I say they never took your sense of humor away. And I went, well, that's something they couldn't get out of us. You could have battered me, left us a bloody mess on the ground, but you'd never break my pride, you'd never break my spirit, because I had a one-track focal, and that was to get home to my family, whatever it cost. If I had to do 5 years, so be it, but I would get home to see my family. And now, I think it doesn't matter how big or small the negative is in life, if you do a bit of digging and look at it different angles, you will get a positive out of it. It may be a small positive, but it's a positive nevertheless. And that positive can turn into a bigger positive if you work with it and do it. So at the beginning, you would fight and rebel against the prison authorities. And then you think, well, it's not working. How do we get things? How do we allow our letters to go out to our family? How do we allow certain products in a parcel to come to us? Let's build a rapport with the prisoners. Let's build a rapport with the prison authorities. They always went, help you, help me, blah, blah. And then I can be a little hot-headed time. And I thought, you know, I'm going to bite my lip here. I'm going to do it for my family. I'm going to do it for myself. And then I want these so-called mini luxuries. Not that we had many luxuries whilst in prison, but to us, it was some sort of luxury. So you would not rebel, but go with the flow, so to speak. And that in a way was a mental challenge, going to, you've knocked down that mental wall and you've gone to, say, the next level, because you don't know what's around the corner. You don't know how long it's going to take. So you keep remaining positive. You don't want things to go backwards. You want things to go forwards. And I've always said this during this pandemic, we have to move forward. We cannot go backwards. I think we're hitting a few little bumps, but we are in a way going forwards to a certain extent. But, and it was like that when we were in prison. Sometimes things would go well, and then next minute, there would be a different jailer, and then he would bring his rules, and you'd be like, so we built a rapport with this previous jailer. Now he's taken away what we've just built, so we're now going to have to build a rapport with him. So yes, negative, there's always a positive in there.
How does the pandemic feel for you? You just mentioned it there. What was your view on the way we're dealing with it, as in the public, not the government, maybe?
Oh no, I'm not even going to touch on the government. Everyone's got their own opinions. Everyone has to just follow suit, I suppose. But this is a day in our lives that I hope we never experience again. And I've been in the military. I know what it's like to not be able to speak to your family, have your creature comforts, as we referred them to, in an Afghanistan desert for weeks at a time. But my biggest test was being in prison, having zero. So if I thought being in a desert in Afghanistan was bad, being in an Indian prison was 10 times worse, because it wasn't people firing weapons at you. It wasn't physical, it was pure mental. And if you lose that, everything else fails. Keep this, everything else goes swimmingly well. And this for me, it's been crap, it's been boring, but I'm lucky I've been able to work throughout. I'm quite fond of doing fitness. So I've got resistance bands. I mean, mates lent us a few little mini weights and stuff like that. And I just use my knowledge to help me mentally. The gym for me is a big mental progression in life. That's why when we were in prison, we built a Flintstone gym. And you can see the pictures on me Twitter, etc. We took a negative and we got a positive out of it, like I was saying just before. And I've been in a prison with nothing. People, I was getting angry with myself and biting my lip, because when you hear and seeing people on social media and that going, oh, I feel like I'm in a prison. Oh, I felt like saying, you have no idea what it's like being in a prison. But I didn't. I kind of went through a different avenue around it, and I went, I can understand where you're coming from. It is quite boring. You're unable to go out. You're being told to stay and save lives, etc. It is a massive disruption in our way of life. This has never happened since 100 years ago.
I think that what we've got to do is maybe put it on his head and say, how lucky we are that we're free, constantly free. And I think rather than saying how miserable we are that we're locked down, I mean, it's loosening up now, but how amazing it is when we're not locked down, how bloody free we are in this country. Our freedom is something else.
Definitely. I totally agree. You look at all the other countries and how they've been able to police it in this annual. I'm not going to go political, but what I will say is our British government has trusted the British public to use common sense. They don't want to enforce a full lockdown. I can remember in the early months, people going, we need military action, we need martial law. And I'm going, do you actually know what martial law is? Do you really want paratroopers on the streets in Robocop gear braying people because they're out of the outside? No, you don't. That's the last thing you want. I had to mention because that's what my old unit was. No, but do people realise what a martial law is? No, they don't. They actually haven't got a clue. And that would send us backwards. We have to move forward and say what you say. Have we handled it correctly? Have we not? But that's not for me to decide. I'm not a government official. But seeing people's thinking, I'm in a prison, I'm bored. You've got Netflix to gorge at. You've got YouTube to gorge at. You can ring your family. I know how upsetting it is. You don't have to tell me what it's like to not see your family. I couldn't see my family for 4 years. You can pick up a phone. You can stand at their gate while they're stood at the door. And the people, and I hate it when people said, well, I can't go and see them. You can. Stand at the gate while they're stood at the door. That is big. That's mental. Mm. You physically see how they are. You can see them. Video calling. Amazing. Amazing. I do it even today.
Nick, one of the things that is reoccurring during this conversation is time. You're talking a lot about time, and you know, it must be, does time sort of come to a standstill when you're in an Indian prison not knowing your future?
Yes, every day was the same. Every time when that prison door shut and the metal clanging sound and the turning of the keys, you'd get goosebumps. The hair would stand up on my neck and it would be eerie quiet. And all that goes through my head was just my family. You know, and I turned and looked at my wall and I saw the pictures that I stuck on my wall next to my little bed space. And that's when the reality would hit. And every day that I was in India, especially when I was in prison, it felt like time had stopped. It wasn't going forward because a lot of the time, nothing was happening. For, you know, I remember coming back to the UK and speaking with, you know, people who were in the judicial system and telling them, this is what was happening. And they were shocked. They were like, say that again, Nick? And I said, yeah, they went on a strike. The lawyers went on a strike. And they were like, a lawyer strike? What on earth is one of them? They'll just go, well, you've lost your lawyer, get another one. Mental, absolutely mental. If you want to go on and look at different countries around the world on like 1 out of 10, 1 being not mental, 10 being mental, I think India's pretty much nearly like a number 10. It is a mental country. And you don't realise how good we've actually got. The stuff we take for granted in our everyday lives, that's something that I do not do nowadays. I appreciate we've all taken things for granted, but freedom is something that I will never take for granted.
100%. I can't tell you how often I say that to people, especially my children. Don't ever eradicate freedom. Make sure we keep that because it's the one thing we have as over here. Which we should treasure. We can all tell in your voice how mentally hard it was, the strain on you. Physically, how was it when you got out and you came back to Britain and you looked in the mirror? What did you see?
I felt like I'd aged about 20 years. I remember waking up in 2015 and I woke up and I woke up with a crease on my forehead. I thought, oh my God, where's the beauticians? I need a filler of something. The stress. I looked when I came home, and I looked in a mirror on UK soil. I felt like I've survived hell. I feel like I've endured hell mentally. But I felt like it's over. And I felt like I'd aged about 20 years. And then I had a haircut and I feel like I lost 20 years.
tell us about that moment then, the moment that you realized you were going to be released. What did it actually feel like? None of us are really going to experience this. So what does it feel like when they say you're actually going to go home?
It's a weird way to put it. Picture your knees getting taken away. A massive, nice punch to the stomach. You just feel incapacitated because you've had so much misery prior, and you're getting told good news. Your mind's thinking, how do we compute this? How do we take it in? Is it real? Because we've had so many ups and downs on this journey, and now we're being told it's over. How do you just bubble? Do you just jump around like a lunatic cheering? You're just full of mixed emotions, but amazing when you see the other guys in that buzzing, especially those who were quite doom and gloom and upset and missing their families. We all miss our families. But to be told, yeah, the government is coming to get you. Get your stuff ready. Unbelievable. I remember exactly what happened. Like it happened yesterday, because it's such a big, happy moment in my life. Like I said, it doesn't matter what the negative is. You'll always, always get a positive out of it eventually. And we did. Like I said, Judgment Day. I say this in my book, and it sounds corny and cheesy, but the night before, it was a Sunday night, the radio was playing rock ballads, and the final countdown came on. And I stood up in our cell, I went, lads, this is it. Tomorrow, it's over. And they're like, let's see what happens. I said, no, that's it. That's a sign. And I spent many times trying to talk to him upstairs, behind the toilets, the stinking horrible place, which no one, even the Indians went, Nick, why are you behind here? It stinks. Go away. Just go somewhere else. Are you mental? I was like, no, this was my place where I used to confine in myself.
Are you religious?
I'm not, no, but in desperate measures in life, you do wish you had an extra helping hand. And anyone who is religious says your sign will happen when you least expect it. And I believe that's the sign that we were all waiting for. That song, The Final Countdown. And then no one slept in that cell that night. So the next day, as soon as the cell opened at 6 o'clock in the morning, I was like, I need to get out and train. So, because I'm tired. And then I did another session in the evening. There was like 40 cases, and ours was the last surprise of the day. Just to keep on edge a bit, you know. So we'd use the prison phones to ring Indian numbers. So a couple of the guys went to ring our lawyer around lunchtime, and she said nothing yet, but we will get heard today. Trust me. And it was around 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening. And I remember being where our prison cell was, and our compound behind it was a mango tree. And that was a bit of a shaded area. So that's where we built and had our little Flintstone gym. So I was busy outside training. And one of the other Brit guys who came to give me the good news out through our barred window. And you know when you hear someone's voice and it's quite shaky and full of emotion, and you don't know whether they want to cry or jump around in glee or anything like that. And he went, he called us my nickname. He went, Dunny. I went, what? He went, case acquitted. And I was like, I told you. And I tried to carry on training and my knees just gave way. I went, I can't do this. And obviously you can imagine that night, no one slept, but the best was yet to come and it's never been happened before. Normally to leave prison, you've got to wait for your court paperwork. But when the grandest judge of all of India's gave a direct order to get us out of prison because the captain of our ship had bone cancer. So while our case was stood at high court waiting on a decision for 1 year, which they reluctantly did, he wanted to go out to see his family to die, basically, in hospital. He recovered, and I wish him all the best if he's there. Hopefully he's still alive today, I don't know. But his case went through the court system right up to Supreme Court, and obviously not, and I'm not going to quote, but it was more or less, why are you still in our country? So our legal team jumped on and went, well, Your Honour, they're still waiting on a decision. So he went, I want a decision within 2 weeks. A week later, we got that judgment day, which was Monday the 27th of November 2017. And then obviously we got it the next day. I had to get out, so I was training. One of the lads got summoned to the superintendent. So as I was walking around the compound, he was coming back in. And it's probably the most happiest, relieving moment of my life when he goes, because I shout, I went, what's the superintendent say? And he just turned and looked at us and went, embassy's coming at 11 o'clock.
Wow.
Get your stuff together. And I was gobsmacked. My knees just gave way. I felt like crying. I felt like jumping around like a lunatic. But most of the thoughts that was going through my mind was, how is my family reacting to this news? And
wow.
It was just an amazing, amazing feeling.
Nick, I think we should leave the story there because it's a fantastic story and it's all in your book, Surviving Hell. Before you go, I've got a list of questions that I ask all my guests. So I'd like to quickly run through them with you. By the way, did you ever get paid for the job on the ship?
No.
No, no, Nick. Get that money. You went through hell.
If I was to say how much I was owed during the 4 years, because the company told our families we would continue to pay the men, never.
Oh, no.
I received no compensation from the Indian government for wrongful imprisonment. I've received nothing. I've had to rebuild my life. I came home with nothing, apart from the clothes on my back and my pride intact.
It's tough. It's tough what you've been through, Nick, really tough. And you can tell in your voice how tough it is. Right, let's ask these questions to you. What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
My advice is to set goals in life, have aspirations, realistic goals, most importantly. Never take things for granted. Appreciate life. Remember, be a family person, because when they're not there, that's when it hits hard. Take each day as it comes, because you never know what's around the corner, and I know that more than anyone.
Yeah, you do. Right, what's something you think people should know?
Never give up in life. We go through challenges in our everyday lives, whether they're big or small. And when everything in life is thrown to you and it's a bad thing, never give up. Always try and find that positive in that negative. That's how I've dealt with it. And I will continue to endure the rest of my life with that mind thought process.
Great advice. Any life hacks?
If you're going to go traveling around the world, a lot of people, especially people in university in their gap years, have some wits about you. Do some research in the country that you're going to. We've all seen the programs banged up Brits Abroad. Always look at the country you're going to, what their laws are. It may be easy to get away with it in our country, but not in their country. It may be a couple of months or a year, say a prison sentence here. It could be life over there. Mm. Always have your wits about you.
Good advice again. Is there something you've changed your mind about, Nick?
I think years ago, I used to always plan things. And now, I'm just taking each day as it comes. Yeah, I still will plan. Say if I was to go on holiday, obviously that's a thing down the line. But I think taking each day as it comes, that's a big thing for me. All right. Never used to do that.
Can you recommend a book? Were you able to read books in prison? Were there any?
Yes. That was what got me through a lot of time, books. Obviously, I could recommend you one book. You know, there's a nice book from a person called Nick Dunn called Surviving Hell. But no, I read quite a lot of Lee Child's Jack Reacher novels and a lot of books by Damien Lewis, who does a lot of military kind of books, mainly around World War II and the SCS. They were great books to read.
Though, isn't it frustrating reading about people being free and having adventures when you're stuck? Or are you able to... Well, is it frustrating doing that?
No, because your mindset's set differently. You know, it's just a book. A few people had sent were books of people had been in prison, like Nelson Mandela, and I'm thinking, are people writing that? Why do I want to read about someone in prison whilst in prison? I couldn't get my head around that when someone decided to send that book. I was like, this must be a joke of some sort.
Brilliant. Final question, Nick. What's the meaning of life?
Well, I think the meaning of life is to appreciate life, appreciate freedom, because we are in a country that is free. It's a democracy. And I think don't take things for granted. That's the big thing. Be the family person, because you only get one chance in life. And it's to make the best of it. We're born and eventually we do die. It's what happens in between that. Make the best of your life. Strive. Do things. Make yourself happy. We can't always be happy. But like I said, take that little negativity. Try and turn it on a flip side to be positive. But most importantly, I think, is spend time with your loved ones. And because when they're not there, that's when it really hits hard. So take all the opportunities you get in life and go with it, because you're never going to get them opportunities again.
Nick, absolutely lovely to speak to you, and a great place to end it there. Your book is called Surviving Hell. If people want to follow you, Twitter?
Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
What's your handle on them all? Just that Nick Dunn, is it?
Just Nick Dunn, basically.
Oh, with two N's, Nick Dunn.
So yes, D-U-D-U-N-N.
Brilliant. Nick, thank you so much for speaking to us. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks a lot.
No problem, Tim. Thank you very much.
That was Nick Dunn, and his book is called Surviving Hell. This podcast is sponsored by Cooker, spelt Quicker, pronounced Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I want to thank him so much for sponsoring this podcast. If you want to speak to me at all, you can email me at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com, or you can always get me on Twitter at Tim Lovejoy. I'll see you very soon for another podcast. Please let us know. Give us some feedback on what you think of these podcasts. But yeah, I'll see you very soon. For the time being, peace and love, joy.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.